Welcome to the World We Got This podcast, brought to you by King's College London. In this series, we take a look at the complex issues of the world today. We ask those researching and studying these fields about the challenges we face and what society needs to do to help solve them. Across Europe, the far right has seen its popularity increase in recent years, and many are predicting it will see large gains in this year's European parliamentary elections. How widespread is this sharp turn to the right, as some have labelled it? And how is it changing the political landscape across the continent? What's the impact on other political parties? How might it affect the UK post-Brexit? And is there anything we can do to halt or reverse the rise of the far right across Europe? My name is Julie Weldon, and in this episode, brought to you by the Faculty of Social Science and Public Policy at King's College London, we're going to discuss these questions with Dr. Georgios Samaras, Assistant Professor in Public Policy at our International School for Government. Welcome, Dr. Samaras, to The World We Got This. Can I start by asking you to give us a sense of the current popularity of the far right across Europe and how this reflects a change from the past?
After World War II, there was a change in how European citizens perceived political ideology. And for several years after World War II, such parties could not really gain popularity because of how powerful the memories used to be. Now, fast forward to 2024, and we see some alarming incidents across Europe where the far right is becoming more powerful as a result of a strong commitment to tradition, against migration, and against issues related to gender. The reason why politics of memory is no longer playing a role is because of how the lines between the far right and the center right are being blurred. So we can see that some ideological characteristics appear to be neutral. And when they become common amongst right-wing entities, it's very difficult to distinguish between those. So people do not really perceive the far right as far right. There's tons of examples across Europe, from Italy with the Brothers of Italy and Giorgia Meloni to Viktor Orban in Hungary, who basically led the country to an authoritarian hybrid regime, to Germany with the AfD rising and becoming one of the most extremist versions of the far right in Europe at the moment, and of course Greece with previously Golden Dawn and now three far right parties in the parliament: Nikki, Spartans, and of course the Greek Solution. So, within the current political landscape of the EU, a new trend emerged amongst far-right movements, where there is a new emphasis set on engaging in cultural battles, also known as cultural wars, that extend beyond traditional political discourse. So these factions, the focus is primarily set on trans rights and the preservation of what they perceive as traditional societal values. So this is central to the rhetoric, and this is part of a critique of what they often label as wokeism, to encompass a spectrum of progressive ideologies. Some of these far-right voices ultimately argue that we need to return to tradition. And those trends are also amplified by how they present themselves as defenders of tradition and cultural stability and nationality as well. So it's a combination of values related to tradition and cultural stability. I would also add that this emphasis on cultures kind of underscores a broader ideological divide within the EU, one that extends beyond policy differences to encompass deeply held beliefs about identity, societal norms, and the trajectory of progressivism.
And how is the far right affecting other parties? For example, in some articles you've published recently, you've said that you think some of their ideologies already pervade European politics and lines are getting blurred. Can you say more about that?
Of course. So this is a big issue right now in European politics, because we observe the blurring of far-right ideologies with those of the center-right. And this phenomenon is underscored by many examples, as the center-right finds itself losing ground to more extreme factions and subsequently adjusting its strategies to court voters. So key issues such as migration and gender values have significantly influenced the rhetoric and policies of the center-right parties. For example, even in the UK, we have seen this discussion about what is a woman or why do trans people gain access to toilets, or, of course, all the issues with discourse about the channel, about migration. Non-issues have become issues. And I think that the Tories, the Conservative Party, is a very interesting example, because if we look back at Theresa May's tenure as Prime Minister and the transformation of the party has undergone, we can see that its stance has changed dramatically. So similar dynamics, of course, can be observed in most European countries, including the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union in Germany, with Greece, New Democracy, Italy, Brothers of Italy, yes, under Giorgia Meloni. So these parties are firmly rooted in traditional conservative principles, but they have faced pressure to adapt to this changing political landscape by incorporating elements of far-right discourse into their platforms. And this, of course, has multiple implications, because it blurs the lines between mainstream conservatism and extremist ideologies. Of course, the one ideology that benefits from this is extremism. So as the center-right continues to navigate these challenges, it must strike a delicate balance between appealing to a broad base of voters and upholding its core principles if it's going to survive. And that is a question, of course, that can be directed to politicians within the center-right that like to blur those lines. It has become a trend.
So looking at the European parliamentary elections this year, what trends should we look out for? How do you think the European Parliament might change once the votes are in? And how likely is it that some of these far-right parties will actually achieve power?
I'm not sure about what trends we're going to see, but approximately 25% of the seats are projected to be secured by far-right factions. So this is expected to significantly bolster their sway over policy formulation and decision-making processes within the governing bodies. The majority of those far-right parties are quite powerful in their countries, if we look at Brothers of Italy or Fidesz in Hungary. So the prospect, you know, of a coalition forming between the European People's Party, EPP, and the European Conservatives and Reformists cannot be discounted, which means that the far-right and the center-right are both coming together. So consequently, political entities, such as the ones that I just mentioned, may find themselves wielding more influence in these proceedings compared to their position back in 2019. There will be more focus on geopolitical tensions, for sure, an overwhelming focus on migration. And finally, I would say that we're going to see the EPP dismantling some of its key pledges when it comes to green policy, as they've already done after publishing their manifesto a few weeks ago in Romania. There is a lot, of course, to discuss about the future direction of the EPP, but if a coalition is formed between EPP and ECR, things will be quite uncertain in terms of policy.
Looking at this from a UK perspective, since Brexit, do the European parliamentary elections still matter to the UK? And if so, in what ways?
Yeah, my answer would be no, but it's not necessarily the European election that might have an impact on the UK. I would say that the stability and the structure of the European Parliament might have an impact on the decision-making of NATO. So the NATO developments are the ones that we need to pay attention to, but they could, of course, exert some influence on decision-making processes, particularly, you know, with the heightened emphasis on defense spending, which is on the table, and it's been an ongoing discussion for several months now. So this shift prompted, of course, the UK to align its policies accordingly and find middle ground with some of them. Brexit has undoubtedly left its mark, but it no longer dominates the concerns of the electorate to the same extent as before. If now the Labour Party comes to power, it would be a very interesting experiment, because in the last 14 years, the Tories have been negotiating, discussing, and of course working with their European counterparts, which of course were led by the EPP. So we had two conservative factions, centre-right factions, dealing with policy. If the Labour Party comes to power after the next election, it'll be useful to see how those dynamics could change. So it's TBC, TBD actually.
And has Brexit had an impact on attitudes and on voters in other parts of Europe?
I'm not sure if Brexit triggered actually any dramatic changes in the way the European Union handles migration. Of course, there have been dramatic changes, but they were not triggered by Brexit. I think that Brexit showed that isolationist approaches by the UK government can definitely have an impact on how countries communicate, because the UK crashed out of the EU. But since 2016, so many other things have happened with migration that have inevitably led the EU to take a different approach towards tackling migration and uncontrolled immigration. So no, I don't think that Brexit as a whole has had an impact on migration, but it has changed the way countries communicate, especially France and the UK, about migration.
Again, picking up on some of the articles that you've written recently, you've called on the centre-right to behave differently and rediscover their own identities. What do you mean by that, and what about the other parties?
The centre-right is exhibiting a noticeable shift towards aligning with far-right ideologies, so raising concerns about how to effectively curb the rise of far-right extremism without becoming complicit in its agenda. This marks a significant departure from the post-World War II era, as we discussed before, where such dynamics were far less pronounced. So it's crucial for the centre-right to address this trend instead of becoming the far-right, and prevent further entrenchment within far-right narratives in general. Now, what about other parties? I think that contrary to this rightward drift, there seems to be less evidence of a corresponding radicalization within left-leaning factions. So the current political landscape underscores the urgency for the centre-right to confront the growing influence of far-right elements while safeguarding democratic values. This is not what we see in the left. So I would argue that a lot of examples across Europe have openly sided with parties that embrace a more radicalized agenda. We can also see that in Austria with FPÖ. This is something that historically the left has not done, with only a few exceptions. For example, Syriza in Greece, where in order to govern, Alexis Tsipras in 2015 decided to form a coalition government with a far-right party called Independent Greeks. But this is just a standalone example that is unique in the European context. In short, the centre-right must find or rediscover its own identity instead of becoming the new far-right.
Alongside the rise of the far-right, we are also seeing a growth in authoritarian regimes around the world. How is the EU reacting to this, and should it be doing things differently?
The EU must address the situation promptly, particularly given the concerning authoritarian trends evident in countries like Hungary and previously Poland. And under Viktor Orban's leadership, Hungary has been increasingly criticized for its drift towards autocracy, while Greece has witnessed a troubling decline in democratic standards. So these are two unique examples. Hungary is going down the authoritarian path, whilst Greece is an example of democratic backsliding. So what we see here, though, is quite interesting, because on the one hand, you have an authoritarian leader in the making, Viktor Orban, but Greece presents a paradox. While it professes commitment to European values, it demonstrates some of the most authoritarian tendencies, especially concerning human rights issues and, of course, violation of democratic rights in general. This dichotomy hints at the adoption of authoritarian practices that can be basically achieved in a very cheeky way. And Greek democracy is quite fresh and new, and it can't be manipulated and eroded. That is something that the EU must actively address. It has actually addressed it. It did address it on February the 7th, if I remember correctly, where they passed a resolution condemning the government's actions. So this is a first step towards the right direction, but the EU must make sure that democracy survives within its member states. And most importantly, when there is democratic backsliding that is so evident and so clear, it must take action against those nations.
Turning now to Russia, Putin has become president again in an election that's been widely condemned as a sham. And of course, there is the ongoing war in Ukraine. What's the role of the EU in relation to Russia?
And that is a very difficult question to answer, because I feel that Putin has managed to become one of the leading authoritarian figures and was constantly enabled by European Union's structures. One of them was the reliance on Russian energy, which was never addressed since the early noughties, with Schröder, of course, being the Chancellor of Germany. There was an open communication that normalized this communication, general communication of the EU with authoritarian leaders. Now, although I don't think that the EU is responsible for any of this, what happens in Russia at the moment, because it's not part of the European Union, so we can't blame Europe for everything. But doing business with authoritarian leaders can have some very interesting political consequences. One of them is that there are copycats everywhere. We can see that Hungary has embraced that. Again, I'm not blaming the EU for that, but what is going on right now in Russia can result in more copycats appearing in Europe. Poland was on the same path for several years under their previous government, and it seems that some countries that are experiencing democratic backsliding, despite presenting themselves as the anti-Russian bloc, they are using actual authoritarian practices to achieve that. If we look at Greece and the wiretapping scandal, which was a very prominent case in the European Union context, it shows us that openly pro-Europeanists don't hesitate to use those practices. So the question is, what can the EU do about that so that we make sure that the influence and the, I would say, tremendous authoritarian wave that arises right now in Russia doesn't impact more European nations? In short, I would say that Putin is an influence, a very strong influence that many people admire in politics because of how ruthless and how effective he is in Russia, using authoritarian practices to dominate. And of course, Ukraine plays a huge part in this, because if we look at Ukraine and if we assess the situation, European Union has decided to side with Ukraine and help the whole nation in that war. What comes, of course, after the European election and after the American election is a completely different discussion, but this will also have consequences on EU policy for sure.
You participated in a recent event about the use of spyware across Europe and how this is a potential threat to democracy. Can you explain more about that?
Back in 2022, it emerges that the Greek government licensed highly advanced spyware called Predator to surveil politicians, political opponents, and journalists. It was discovered right after the head of the Socialist Party PASOK, Nikos Androulakis, gave his phone to the European Union authority that is responsible for such violations, and they discovered that Predator was installed in his phone. A number of employees within the Greek National Intelligence Service spoke confidentially and wanted to leak this to press that the nephew and head of Prime Minister's office, Grigoris Dimitriadis, that's the nephew of the Prime Minister, by the way, was appointed to launch a network of surveillance using Predator, sending bug texts, trying to infiltrate devices, iPhone devices primarily, and in general, create this network of surveillance to be in control of the political landscape. Once this was discovered, several people, low-level people in the government, including Dimitriadis, resigned. And that's how it ended. There was no further investigation. There were tons of reports, tons of articles coming out on all international media, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Politico. It was a huge scandal. No one was prosecuted. No one was convicted. The investigation ended in late 2022. And since then, more coercion force emerged, more revelations were made, but no action was taken by the Greek government to address what actually happened with the scandal, also known now as Greek Watergate. Also, there is Poland and Spain and some latest reports coming from Belgium about politicians' phones infected with spyware. A Politico actually published a few interesting reports a few weeks ago. And also, Poland's right-wing leader, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but they have discovered that there is an involvement, a certain involvement of Kaczynski, who is the right-wing leader right now in Poland, who was questioned about the use of Pegasus. That is another Israeli software spyware employed by governments. So it's not that widespread, but some countries are using it. Governments abuse communications in order to surveil political opponents. So it is more common than we knew. We don't know how common it is, but these are the 3-4 examples that we've seen across Europe.
And how might such activities impact on democracy across Europe, and why do you think people should be concerned about it?
The EU has initiated certain measures to address the use of illegal spyware. And in that event, we actually discussed that these efforts remain insufficient. There is an urgent need for more robust policy interventions to counteract the alarming trend of governments employing illegal methods to surveil journalists, politicians, often under the pretext of national security concerns. In regards to Greece, which is the example where democracy has been impacted, the country has openly engaged in such practices without facing any sanctions from the EU. So the scandal surrounding this issue has never been subjected to a thorough investigation, allowing the government to evade accountability and sweep the matter under the rug. This is a lack of transparency and oversight, and it's very concerning and warrants serious attention because it has an impact on democracy, political accountability, and of course, the quality of democracy as a whole. It is imperative that we remain vigilant about such issues because it's an abuse of power. It's an abuse of democracy, and we need to advocate for stronger mechanisms to safeguard the privacy and rights of individuals. 2 years ago, it was the leader of PASOK, several politicians, several journalists. Who knows who would be next? So the EU must take decisive action to address these violations and hold accountable those responsible for undermining democratic principles. And again, I'm going to repeat it because I said it in my last response. The government of Greece right now presents itself as a pro-Europeanist force in center-right politics. That is a paradox. If such authoritarian measures and practices are adopted by government, it shows a lack of commitment to European values. This is not what Europe is about. And a long-term use of such methods can erode democracy. Like I previously said, Greek democracy is quite fresh because up until mid-70s, there was a military dictatorship in power. This manipulation must end in order for democracy to survive and flourish. EU has a part in this and must play an active role in addressing the bad boys of the EU.
How worried should ordinary voters be about some of the political activities and trends we're seeing across Europe? And what action would you like to see from society to address some of the concerns that you've outlined in our conversation today?
This is a very difficult question, but I would say that political changes are nonstop. And despite all the fear-mongering that the far right will emerge, I would say that it's very difficult to see instant policy interventions by the far right, even if they get 25% of the seats. However, the EU must actively address all the issues related to democracy and the quality of life across Europe, because those political changes have the potential to impact democracy. Now, this is going to sound very theoretical, but as Levitsky often has argued through his analysis, just because it is labeled as a democracy, it doesn't really feel like a democracy. Not all groups in society, especially disadvantaged groups, feel the benefits of a democracy. So that's my main concern, that the erosion of democracy can impact mainly vulnerable groups and minorities across Europe. And to some extent, democracy must be protected, but we need a more open discussion and debate about what we could do to improve and fortify democracy. How, for example, migration, which is one of the most important issues right now in European politics, can be somehow discussed in more depth, not just by arguing that the EU must fortify its borders and stop any people from coming in, especially when there are asylum laws in place that protect the rights of migrants. In short, we must be alarmed about the right of far-right extremism and how those democratic norms can be protected, because European democracy has been trying to fix and address some of those issues through legal frameworks, but their implementation is not really that great. And promoting democracy must be a priority for most European governments at this stage to avoid any surprises in the future with the rise of far-right parties that might be able to form coalition governments. We are about to see that happening in Austria, where we saw that in Italy. If that trend emerges, I think that there will be some serious issues with the quality of democracy as a whole.
And what about us as individuals? What can we do?
I think that activism is the number one way to address those issues and be more involved in politics. I have faith in younger generations, like millennials like myself and Gen Z, that they can change things. And we've seen the demonstrations in February in Germany against AfD, for example, that resulted in millions, actually, of young people protesting against far-right extremism. That has an impact, and that sends an actual message to political forces that they will be held accountable of the country that basically initiated World War II and resulted in the killing of millions of Jews, people of color, migrants, any groups in society that were considered as a threat by Hitler. That country is now seeing the rise of a far-right party that has reached a 20%. That is a reason to become an activist. If I was in Germany right now, I would be protesting every day if I had the opportunity, because that is a huge danger to democracy. So my point is that activism works. The involvement with activist groups works. Anti-fascist movements across Europe have played a significant role in tackling the rise of the far-right. And I have faith that this can happen again in 2024, now that we're reaching a critical point where far-right parties have a voice in governance, in shaping policy, and also taking decisions at the highest level. And we will start seeing that starting from June with the European election, because 25% of the seats taken by far-right parties is a significant number.
Thank you so much, Dr. Samaras, for all your insights today into how the political landscape in Europe is changing, some of the challenges it's creating, and what each of us can do to address some of the concerning trends that are emerging across the continent. We really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us today. If you're interested in gaining further insights from experts across King's around this extraordinary year of elections, do check out our Poll to Poll 2024 series of expert comment and events on the King's website. You can find it by typing KCL Poll to Poll into your browser and it should just pop up. We will be adding to the series and looking at the significance of elections all around the world. So do keep checking in on the series, or you can follow us on X. We are at King's SSPP to keep up with all the latest updates.
You have been listening to the World We Got This podcast. This episode was produced by the Faculty of Social Science and Public Policy at King's College London and edited by Rachel Wall. To find out more about the research at King's on this and other global challenges, please visit our website, kcl.ac.uk. Please review, subscribe and share the podcast so you don't miss an episode and it's easier for others to find out about the series.